I'm going to start just very briefly, and I want to talk about system documents and documents in general, and then I'll dive into branch cache. So just roughly, this is what I'm going to talk about. So I want to just talk about system overview documents for a moment to put some context in this. Then I will describe the content caching. We call it content caching and retrieval because we didn't want to use the trademark name branch cache, but it basically is synonymous. Okay, that's the only reason why we didn't call it branch cache system overview. Legal got in the way. And then, so having talked about that and related documents, we'll dive in and have a little look a bit more at branch cache itself. I keep wanting to go over there to press the laptop. I'm not used to having this fancy technology. So just, I know you guys are probably interested in the technical documents and probably don't pay too much attention to the fact that there's different protocol programs and what does that mean. I don't really want to get dived into them too deep, but I just want to point out to you that when you're looking for documents, a little awareness of the different programs makes it kind of easier to find the right document. So if you go to the website, the Open Protocols website, you will find there's actually three document sets, roughly. There's MCPP, which is the Microsoft Client Protocol, which is basically, put simply, the antitrust case in the US. Okay, and as it says, there are protocols used by Windows Server operating systems to communicate with Windows clients operating system. So there's a bunch of docs there. Then there's the European case, which is called WSPI. So protocols used by Windows Server operating systems to provide file, print, and user group administration services to Windows workgroup networks. So it was kind of caged slightly differently. But what that gives you that this doesn't is basically server-to-server protocols. Okay. There is a big overlap as well, and I'll talk about that overlap just in a second. We've also got this thing called MIP that's come along, the so-called Microsoft Interoperability Program, and that added a whole bunch of other documents, and largely, without going through them all, there's roughly what you get, okay? So the different programs, but I really just want to focus at the moment on these two sets, if you like the sort of historical ones. I noticed just sitting in this morning, and I've sat in other days as well, we tend to use terminology, and it might not always be obvious to you, unless you're kind of pretty intimate with the documents. You'll notice we've talked about block protocols frequently. And actually, there's four templates. So all the technical documents, TDs is what we call the protocol specifications. Okay? If you've heard the term TD, what the heck is that? It just means technical document. It means the protocol specs. They follow three basic templates, the so-called block protocol, which is really basically, it doesn't look like it goes in one of the other buckets, so it goes in that bucket, okay, is the way it is. But what these do for you is the actual layout of the document's slightly different. That's the bottom line. If you're looking at the document, the layout's slightly different, and it gives you extra information that's appropriate to the type of protocol. Okay, so TDs, technical documents, if you've looked at any of them at all, the specs, if you looked at SMB or whatever, SMB is a block protocol. We also have the so-called system documents, and these are guys that sit above protocol documents that describe how a bunch of protocols interact together as a system. Okay? Now, there's a couple of things worth saying. Not all technical documents automatically fall into a system, so there's not like a one-to-one correspondence that says, if I have a technical document here, it's automatically part of a system over there. I probably should have a lawyer sitting on my shoulder. I probably shouldn't be saying things like, actually, we've got protocols that nobody wants to implement. You know, it's like ADA, you know. I'm going to pick an ADA now, you know. Go and implement ADA. That's really good for your productivity. You know. So quite blunt, we do have things you don't want to implement. And they're not, frequently they're not part of systems. There's a protocol that follows me around. First time I came across it when I joined Microsoft, it's called MS Tail. I don't suppose anyone's ever looked at it. It was to do with NetMeeting and internet location services. If anyone's ever used the old NetMeeting service, you could log on as a user. So basically a directory on the internet, and it logged you on. You could see the other people that were online. It's long gone. There's better things. And you think, well, who would possibly be interested in that? Well, rather embarrassingly, it turns out the porn industry. So we have the Department of Justice encouraging us to document protocols that are used by the porn industry. I'm not sure that, you know, That's the sort of thing that would make politicians cringe, I suspect. But so I diverge. So we do have system documents. They describe groups of protocols. You've heard about some of them. There's a file system access one. I'm about to talk about the branch cache or content retrieval. There's a printing one, and so on. So we've got a group of them. I'll say a bit more about this. We've got a group of them in what we call MCPP space in the US, under the US ruling. So there's a bunch of them there. We've currently got in progress a bunch of work to do a whole bunch more in the EU, in the so-called EU space. They'll be a little different in that the US ones are very prescriptive and are basically like technical specifications. The ones in the EU space, different rulings, different laws, different, we're told to do it, are going to be narrative style. So they'll be more scenario-based. So there will be a difference in them. So just give you a feel. MCPP in the American world, if you go and download, the way I do it, it depends on one stage. You can look at these things online in HTML, but I always just go grab the zip files, frankly, of PDFs. And this is the sort of thing you get. You get system documents. I'll talk about this in a second. They break down into two style of system document. There's a bunch of reference documents you might never have looked at, by the way. And then, of course, there's the so-called technical documents, which is by far the biggest list, in fact. You know, there's several hundred of them. And then there's things like MS Gloss, which is just glossary of terms. MSD Type, which started life as just type definitions. It's got a bunch of other things in there these days. It's got like access algorithms, how to apply ACLs and things like that. All the error codes, basically. Locale specific information. It's a bunch of stuff about how Windows uses Unicode. And there's this new document, MSADMS. Now, I don't know how many people are familiar, but the technical documents have what we call ADMs in them, abstract data models. Essentially, that's the state information needed to write a protocol. A number of these states that are in, say, one protocol are shared with another protocol. And this central document, this is a new guy that's just on the way out, basically lists all the ADM elements that are shared across protocols. It doesn't list all ADM elements, just those that are shared between one or more, more than one protocol, basically. Okay, so that's stuff you can look out for. So that's MCPP, and if you go and grab the zip file, you get 300 out of the files, you know, if that's what you're interested in. In the European space, it's laid out slightly differently. The same basic suspects are there. The TDs are there. I haven't looked at one there, but we could have had a list of them there as well. We get a list of protocol documents, and there are some extra ones in there that are not in MCPP, okay? So there's some server-to-server stuff that isn't in the MCPP bucket. Equally, in the MCPP bucket, there's a bunch of protocols that aren't in the European bucket, okay? If I was being really practical, and you want to not care about this, and you want to have the right document, what you do is you go and grab the zip file for the US, MCPP, you dump that into a directory. You go and grab the EU one and dump it on top, and you pretty well got what you want, okay? But because of the different rulings, we have to have it spread out. But that, and so WISP, the so-called WISPy, the European's a little different. It's narrower in scope and places. You get file and print, user group admin, network and transport. And we're planning to do so-called system documents to address sort of interesting protocols that interact in these spaces as well. So there's more of that to come. That just gives you an idea of basically where we'll be doing more system documents in the future. Okay, they're sort of coming out end of this year. They'll start up here sometime this year. There'll be more of them coming. Okay, I just want to flag this to you, and this is probably the biggest pain. If it's any consolation, we suffer pain from it as well, but at some point, this will go away, but there's, in the MCPP bucket and the WISP bucket, there's documents with the same name, but they don't have the same content, so be wary, okay? I've talked to Samba guys, and they've been kind of caught out with it. Somebody's just wanted the SMB document. They've just, you know, Googled it or whatever, clicked on the first link, and the document pops up, and they haven't checked. And actually, what they got is the MCPP one, which has got less in it, than if you go to the WISPy one, okay? Which is why I said just a few minutes ago, the best thing you do is grab the MCPP, dump it in a directory, and then dump on top of it the wispy ones, because then you end up with the full set the way you would really want it. And we would do it like that as well if we weren't being regulated, quite frankly. Okay, just on that list, so these are documents. This is the names of the documents that have got the same name but are different. There's about three of these that really matter. To be honest, a lot of them, although they're different, the difference is really minor. It's like references to system documents or something, so there's no sort of technical content. NRPC, MSADTS are the two that jump out that have got the biggest difference. Okay, so if you're interested in MSNRPC or MSADTS, you just want to make sure you go grab the WISPI version when you go and looking for them. Okay, so just be a bit wary of that. Back to system documents. So-called system documents fall into two broad categories. We've got so-called defined task documents. So strictly speaking, these aren't systems. What there is there's a bunch of activities that you might want to do, and this describes a sort of end-to-end activity, hence task. So join a computer to a domain would be a good example of a task, okay? And that would, in fact, show up in this one, MS-DISO, okay? So these are task-style documents. And they, you know, I hate to be unkind to people's protocols. Collaboration services is really uninteresting because it's net meeting stuff that's pretty old, and you know. But DISO is pretty interesting. Probably the most interesting of them all. That deals with joining a domain and all a whole lot of related things. So that one is probably the most popular of this set of documents that people look at, and obviously depends on your other interests, what you might be interested in. Also, authentication is obviously pretty important, so that gets looked at. So there's five of these defined task documents, and then there's the so-called protocol family documents. So these are proper systems in a kind of UMLE type way, if you like, that says, here we go, there's a family of protocols, these protocols work together to achieve some, give you some system. And in fact, branch cache is one such thing which I'm going to talk about. So, and there's 13 of these. I've left off on the list WSA. WSO sits at the top of this whole pile, Windows System Overview. It's a sort of uber overview of everything. So I'm not naming it as a family document. It's essentially the overview of overviews, if that's not, frankly, a little bit insane. But so that's what you get from there. Okay, so that's all I was going to say about the documentation set. So just be a little bit wary if you're grabbing documents. It makes sense to pay attention that you got the right thing. I'm about to do an advert for Adobe now, which the lawyers would probably be kicking me as well. One of the things I do, I don't know, if you're having to deal with a lot of the documents, I mean, some of you will probably only use one or two of them, and that's fine. But if you find yourself having to deal with a lot of them, if you actually have the full version of Acrobat, it actually allows you to build individual catalogs. So you can say, you know, build me a catalog for the SMB2 family. And you just add in the documents you want to build. And so it's when you search, it only searches that set. In fact, I've got a couple of catalogs. I have everything, so as that when I do a search, it actually shows up twice. If there's a MCPP document and a WISP document, it will show up twice. And if it doesn't show up twice, it tells you that it's only in one program. So it's kind of helpful to do that as well. Right. So I don't know if anyone's got any questions in these documents and things, but let me dive in and talk about content caching. So this is basically a Windows 7 feature. It says describe protocols that make up the feature known as branch cache. Okay, so this is a protocol family system document. We've got six or so protocols that interact to give us this feature. You know, it's strange. I can't look at the word cache at the moment and not think of Iceland for some reason. Have you heard the joke about them that went with the banking trouble? Did nobody tell you we said send cash? Not ash is the kind of line. So, okay, so branch cache. I'm going to do a little sort of intro into it for those that might not be familiar with it. And then I'm going to talk a bit more about the actual system document, what you can find in it, what it looks like, that sort of thing. So the bottom line is a lot of businesses have this issue where they have so-called branch offices. So basically, a small office sitting remotely across some sort of WAN link. In fact, I pretty much classify myself as this. I work from home, and I'm on the end of a DSL line, and I have several Microsoft computers sitting in my home office. And of course, what's quite irritating is that you've downloaded a document or a file or whatever it is onto one machine, and then you need it on the other one. And you can clearly faff around and copy it and whatever you want to do. But clearly, it'd be much nicer that the next time you clicked on a file that was on the remote system, that if there was something a bit smart behind the scenes, that instead of grabbing it from that DSL link that's well overused or down, usually because of British Telecom or some such thing, that it said, wait a minute, that content is already available on the local area network, let's go grab it from the local area network. And in essence, that's what branch cache does for us. We've got a lot of fancy terminology and other bits, but that, in essence, that's what it does. So the kind of problem, you have this situation, slow links, you're pulling a lot of data over it, and if you look at it, you're actually pulling a lot of data repeatedly over it. My favorite example and big bugbear would be Windows updates. Clearly large chunks of Windows updates goes to more than one machine. I think this is the whole new thing about computing, isn't it? We create our own problem, and then we have to solve the problem we've created. But then that's what they call industry and commerce, isn't it? So the solution to this problem there's essentially two solutions. We have what they call a distributed solution to the issue, and a centralized. Actually, hosted cache is what we call the centralized one, and I'll come to this in a second. And we have a distributed one. So basically, it means that if you've got a bunch of machines in a branch office or in your home office or whatever, and you're connecting to a corporate network somewhere, when you grab the file, that file gets dumped on one of the machines. I shouldn't use the term file. That's why we're using the term content. It doesn't deal in files. Forget file names. This just deals in chunks of binary. Okay, so it doesn't know about files. And it's not really applicable. But the point being is, if a large chunk of a file has landed in my local area network, then the other computers can discover it's there. Okay, and so now we end up with a bunch of infrastructure to make that possible. Okay. The security basic model is basically the normal what you've got in Windows. It doesn't change anything. Okay, so you try and get a file. There's a bunch of caching that happens underneath the hood. So the file, if you had access to a file using normal, say, SMB, if you had the right permissions, etc., to get to that file, then you have the right permissions via branch cache. It doesn't change anything that. In a sense, the whole security thing is transparent to branch cache. We'll see a little bit later, the data that gets shunted around on the LAN, that is encrypted. It's SSL, basically. So there's nothing particular there. So having jumped ahead of myself a little bit, the bottom line is, how to deal with these slow links, not just slow changes every year, by the way. What we thought was slow last year is not so slow, but the same issue, basically. All we do is try to download more stuff if they give it a faster line. And much like transport systems, if you look at the studies that have been done in public transport, if you want to reduce congestion on the roads, the single most effective method, people talk about build extra lanes, build extra roads, but the single and most effective thing to do is have people not make the journey. So same with networking. If you've pulled it over the network once, why the heck are we going back to do it again? Let's not do that. Okay?
The documents I've been reading, the overview docs, are just MSDN docs, actually tell me that it's pulled over twice.
That depends. Okay, sorry. Yeah, repeat the question. So MSDN says it gets pulled over the wire twice. The WAN. Okay, pulled over the WAN. I'll get into this, but the answer to that is depends whether you're using SMB or HTTP. Okay, so it's accurate if you're in the SMB camp. In the HTTP camp. Okay, I'll come to that. Sorry. Yeah, so the question is, you know, if I grab a file and most of that file is local somewhere, it'll grab that. And that's exactly what happens. So if, I'll say a bit more in detail in a second, but it's awful easy to get ahead of myself on this stuff. So just to kind of set the scene, so that's roughly what we're doing. We're going to try and prevent multiple pools of data over the WAN. Okay, that's the target. So the content caching system overview, this is basically what it does. It says highlights the purpose of content caching. Well, that's pretty uninteresting. Describes relationships between the protocols. More importantly, here is the key things that happen within the system. We have content identification. So if we're going to redefine our file system as blocks of binary that we're interested in, we actually have to be able to identify these blocks of binary. You know, what does a block of binary look like? So we have a content identification system for doing that, say, basically chopping up binary into chunks that we can then identify and figure out, is that chunk available on the LAN somewhere, is the bottom line. We clearly want to do content retrieval. So at some point, we actually want to go and get that from wherever it is. We want to retrieve it. Underneath the hood as well, a client that's trying to retrieve a file, it clearly wants to know, is any of that file floating around on the LAN, basically? You know, is there a chunk of it? So it has to do content discovery. So there's a content discovery mechanism. And then we'll see as well, depending on exactly what mode we're working in, for instance, if we've got this so-called hosted cache, which is basically a server that's sitting on the LAN rather than on the long side, the far side of the WAN, clients that get some new piece of content, some new data, might want to offer this, hey, hosted cache server it is. Hey, hosted cache server, I've got this chunk of data. You might want to know that I have it. Are you interested in having a copy? That's basically what goes on. Okay, so that's kind of set the scene. So this dives in and just spells out the names of the actual individual protocols. So we have so-called content caching. They all start peer content caching, blah, blah, blah. MSPCCRC is the thing that tells you about content identification. We use the shorthand hashes, so we build hashes for the content. This basically tells you how to go and take files, chop them up, and build the appropriate hashes, the so-called content identification. If you're on a server 2008 R2 machine, there's actually a tool called HashGen, so you can actually force generation of hashes from the command line if you want to, and there are times when there's an advantage doing that. It feels a little bit clunky, that you can do it, but nonetheless, you can do it. It's worth just spelling out. It's not immediately obvious if you play with the Windows branch cache system that hash generation happens completely independently for the SMB2 and the HTTP. So there is actually two separate buckets where it stores hashes. Okay, so it's done. It's almost like two independent systems, basically, to get the hashes. So there we got a protocol we can go look at that tells all about that. We have a discovery protocol for those people that have looked at web services discovery. Basically, the discovery protocol is when we're in what we call distributed mode. So there's no centralized cache now. There's, say, several PCs, whatever, laptops, sitting on a LAN. One of them is trying to get a file. It gets the hashes, which says, somebody out there might have the bit of file I'm looking at, the bit of data I want, and you can actually make a discovery. It does a broadcast, says, anybody out there got the data that I want, and they can reply. So that's basically a content discovery protocol that forms part of the deal. We then have content retrieval. So, and frankly, content retrieval, for want of a better description, is just a fancy decorated form of HTTP. So the actual retrieval is really HTTP. We have the hosted cache protocol. So again, so that's this is used by both distributed and hosted mode. This is specific to the hosted mode. So hosted mode, you have a server now sitting on the LAN. And so anything that comes over to the LAN can get offered to this. So basically now your cache is centralized rather than distributed, so everything gets chucked into a central bucket. and that there's protocol specific to that. This runs over HTTPS. There's some authentication happens as well, and I'll say a little more about that later on as well. Client authentication happens because the client's going to offer some data to this cache. You just don't want any old client doing that. So there's a bit of authentication takes place. And then essentially what happens, clients offer up chunks of data, say, hey, hosted server, are you interested in my chunk of data? And there's a bit of negotiation goes on. If it's interested, it says yeah, and it gets passed to the hosted cache, and then that becomes available for other clients should they go looking for it. Metadata retrieval. I could almost make a case for not putting these two protocols in as part of Branchcast system, because all these really do, so both SMB2, well, first of all, HTTP and then SMB2, both of them are really acting as channels to obtain these hashes, okay? Now, the thing to be wary of, SMB2 has done a lot of people's head in when you look at that. If I try to get a file, there's a couple of things going to happen. If I try and get a file from a remote system, and I'll look at some of the detail in a moment, I try and get this file, if it's branch cache enabled, I could end up with the hash, okay? So SMB2 is acting as a transport mechanism to give me these hashes. It's, you know, you could call it a channel or a tunnel, whatever you want to call it, to get these hashes over. If branch caching fails for whatever reason, then SMB2 is just your normal file transport protocol, and it just behaves like normal file transport in a sense. So if you don't get the hashes or there is no data cached, then SMB2 is going to be your file transport protocol. That doesn't mean that, you know, that it's somehow part of branch cache in a sense. It does have a role to play, but its role is really only the supplying of hashes. Yeah? That's really what it's about. Okay. So just similarly, HTTP, when I point to a web server, obviously Microsoft's case is going to be IIS, I point to a file on IIS, say, give me that file. If I PCC-RTP is what we call it, and it's actually, again, just a decorated form of HTTP with a thing called PureDist on it. And basically, when I try to retrieve the file with HTTP, if it's PureDist enabed, the web server can give me back the hash. Okay? It's not. Same rule applies, though. If the hash is not available or the data, you know, there's no cache data available, then HTTP is just going to act as an ordinary transport and send me the file using HTTP. Okay? Again, that's not really part of branch cache. So the bottom line is, if branch cache fails, you just fall back to normal position where you have either SMB2 transport or HTTP transport. We have a little, this again, this is from the system overview document. We have protocol. If you've not looked at these, there's a bunch of sort of architecture level diagrams and information that says these are how things are layered. And this is just really laying out the protocols again, showing you a different sort of architectural view of the same information. So I'm not going to labor on. Given that some sales guy had some slides and I saw them, I borrowed some because it's moving parts, so I thought I would do. So I just want to show you briefly. This kind of just showed you. So, main office, where all the stuff's sitting on a file server, so-called branch office, or home office, whatever, somebody's sitting on the end. So this machine tries to get a file. And what actually happens, you know, assuming we've got the moons and suns aligned in the right places, what we actually get back is the hash, the ID. Okay? So then what happens? It says, well, and this is hosted cache, so we've got a hosted cache server we can talk to. So the client machine gets, or a peer gets this ID, and we say, okay, that's good. Is that data on the LAN, basically? And we've only got one place to look at this time. We go look at the hosted cache. So he sends the ID over there, and it turns out this is first time up. There is no cache data. So it actually has to go get the actual data, okay? So the first time, this sort of is back to Chris's question. So first time up, you do get the data. So that's dragged that data across our WAN link for the first time. Having got that data, this peer will now offer that data up to the hosted cache saying, hey, are you interested in this chunk of data I just got? And presumably, given that it wasn't in fact available, the hosted cache is pretty likely to be interested. In this case, he offers offers up the ID of the data. The hosted cache says, yeah, that sounds good. And he actually pulls the data over to the hosted cache. Okay, so, and this, remember, it's not files, this is chunks of data. So this machine, having retrieved a whole file, has now offered up chunks of data to the hosted cache, and that process is going to happen n number of times, whatever n is, to get all the data over there. Another machine on the LAN, maybe a laptop, tries to get the same content now. Same thing happens. He gets the hashes of the IDs come across. Does the same, you remember the first time we do a search, first of all, IDs passed over to the hosted cache, and actually the hosted cache says, ah, yeah, I got your data for you. Here you go. Have the data back. Okay? So that, and that's the classic example of the caching in operation. We drag that data over the WAN once. It's sitting on our hosted cache. We don't need to drag it over the WAN again. And so in answer to Chris's question, it's only come over once in this case. So we're using SMB2, but we don't see it. Sorry, yes, question. Ah, good question. So the question is, how does the second PC discover the hosted cache? Actually, we could have asked that question of the first PC as well. The answer is it's hardwired, actually. Okay. So in Windows case, there's a registry setting or group policy setting that allows you to say what the hosted cache is. Now, just a word of warning, there's a little gotcha there. If you use a fully qualified domain name, you get Kerberos for the security. If you use an IP address or a net BIOS name, it falls back to NTLM. Okay, so just be wary that the choice of hosted cache name has a kind of horrible side effect on what you get. Yes. So the question is, why do the PCs have to be on the same subnet? I've got support men here. Yeah, hold on, get your microphone.
Well, it's going to be a short answer. The answer is no. They don't have to be on the same subnet. Ah. Right, so it's okay for you to reach across to talk to the hosted cache.
Oh, right. They just have to have access to the hosted cache. Yeah,
that's
sorry.
That's exactly right. For distributed cache mode, machines sorry, have to be on the same subnet.
Yeah. Go on.
What you did here is you grabbed the IDs first because they were already computed.
Correct. And we'll come to that. So the question there was, we grabbed the IDs first because they were already computed. Remember, and there's a number of things that are possible there. I said there's a utility called HashGen. If you really wanted them to be available for sure, you could force HashGen on a server. In the case of SMB2 anyway, you could force that to be true, and then you're good to go. The question there is saying, somehow am I going to have the ID of a remote file I've never looked at the first time? Well, first of all, forget files. We're not talking files. We're talking chunks, okay? And in fact, you mean, think about it. If you take a file and chop it up into chunks, and I'll come to exactly the terminology we use in a minute, some of it could be shared between two files quite legitimately. You know, if you've downloaded one version of a document and then edited it, and then I download another version, clearly there's going to be a big bit of overlap, and it is possible, you know, not guaranteed, depends on circumstances, but it is possible that you will get a chunk of data that was from another file. Yeah? Is that? Sorry, was there another question? The answer is you need to go look in the content. Sorry, the answer is what are the keys to the hash? In the content identification protocol, they're all described how to build the keys. So, it's configurable, so it's not. Okay. It's a piece of content. There's a the content identification protocol. Sorry, I should really repeat that. The question was, what is it that's transferred? And the answer is, for want of a better word, there's a data structure transferred across the wire that has these contents. I think I'm right. I think I've got an example just to show what it looks like actually coming up. Okay. Yeah. Sure. So just let me kind of rephrase what you're saying. So the question kind of about latency. Branch cache depends on latency, first of all. So the question is, how does latency affect this? There is an impact to latency. If it's quicker to get the real data, it will get the real data, and you don't, yeah? And in fact, if you're testing this stuff at all, one of the things you've got to do is make the content server, if you've got this, if all of this is on one LAN, you need to play some tricks to slow this connection down, because if this connection's fast enough, you'll just get. Okay, so there's thresholds of latency, and they're configurable again through group policy or the registry. Yeah. So the other kind of, so that's hosted cache, where we've got a cache, a server, server 2008 box sitting on the LAN side. The other kind of almost, I don't know the word I was going to, more casual arrangement, if you like, is distributed cache. And probably a good scenario of this is two laptops sitting in a home, no servers involved, and they happen to be connecting back to the same office. Or maybe you're, I was going to say you're sitting in Starbucks with a colleague. Could be the sort of thing. But so same deal begins. You go get, and you get the ID, assuming the ID is, we've seen, we're kind of getting the feel for this now, assuming the hash is available, we get the ID. I'll say a bit more about HTTP in a bit, but basically the first time you get, try to get the ID in HTTP, that's going to fire off hash generation, and so it'll take a bit of time. I mean, that's the other thing, hash generation could take, it's not an instant process. And so, I don't know, if it's a video file you're transferring, hash generation is going to take time. So it's, which is one of the reasons why, in some cases, you might want to make sure the hashes are available in advance. So we get the idea. So that's pretty much the same. So now it doesn't have a pre-configured hosted cache to talk to. So actually, it does a web services broadcast. Okay, so broadcast is UDP broadcast. Anybody out there interested in this ID, if it doesn't get a reply, and there's timers and things involved with that as well, we do just get the data. Okay, so that's pretty much the same model. The fact that we did or did not have a hosted cache doesn't matter, because the data wasn't available on the LAN anyway. Now we do the same. Second machine grabs the ID, makes a broadcast, and in this case we get a hit. Somebody's actually got the data, so we can go grab the data from this other machine, okay? Yeah, I'll come to that in a second if that's okay. So the question was, is the chunk size fixed? And the answer is yes, it is in Windows. And segments. So I'll come to this in a segment, but basically we've got the notion of units of discovery, segments, and then we have units of download that are blocks, and they're different sizes, and I'll come to that explicitly. So thing basically is, if you think of the branch cache system, the content caching system, it really only matters once you've got this hashes. If you haven't got the hashes, then you're just going to get data. That's the important thing. So if I'm trying to get the data using SMB2, if I don't have the hashes, I'm just going to get the data, and there's no branch cache in effect. And the same works for HTTP. If I try to grab a file and I don't have the hashes, tough. You just get normal HTTP. So the back off position is just normal file transfer, be that HTTP or SMB2. It doesn't really matter. Once we do have the hashes, we can sort of start to play in the party and get interesting. Okay. And basically, the metadata, we do interchange between hash and metadata. We mean the same thing, though. Basically, it's got all the necessary information to allow a peer to uniquely identify specific content for discovery. So it identifies segments, and then within segments, you can identify blocks. And this is the protocol that's all specified in. I don't know, has anyone in here actually tried to implement this stuff yet? I don't know if anyone here or wants to talk about implementing. You're making a start. Okay. I'd be interested to hear afterwards how you get on with the documents, actually. So, in a sense, this is the answer to the question we've been talking about. So, content is considered to be divided into one or more segments. Segments are units of discovery, and each segment is 32 meg, basically. Except for the last one, if it's not divisible by 32. There's a leftover bit, basically. It's not. Okay, we use cryptographic hashes to identify segments and blocks, which means there was the two IDs I think we talked about. The identifier is known as that. It's only marginally easier to pronounce than an Icelandic volcano. You notice nobody ever pronounces that volcano. I like the way that's been avoided. All the newsreaders go, the Icelandic volcano. Unless we get somebody in the room that knows how to pronounce it. Eh? No takers. Segments are divided into blocks. Blocks are what we download. So kind of just this is a simplified version is, you know, I've identified a segment I'm after. I could get blocks. If I'm in distributed mode, I could get blocks coming from different machines to allow me to rebuild my segment. It's worth just reiterating. It's very easy to kind of fall into thinking of files. And this isn't dealing in files, just, you know, slices of binary, basically. Plus, 32 meg plus. Yeah, so this is just repeating the thing. So metadata, you can either get it through SMB 2.1 or HTTP with the pure disk encoding. Yeah? And that's just a kind of reiteration of what we had. Oh, sorry, let me. You'll see, and I'm about to show some of this, BITS, the background intelligent transfer protocol that Microsoft has. Client side of it is basically a specialized form of HTTP, and it will, if you like, you could use the term branch cache enabled. The real difference between BITS and normal HTTP essentially is BITS can do, well, does do range requests, and so that, you know, you can kind of get retries and things with BITS that you wouldn't get with normal HTTP. Just to kind of show you, so if we say this is the content caching, is us sitting on the LAN when the data is available in these segments and blocks from a caching point of view. We can get the hashes using SMB2 or HTTP, and BITS is a specialized version of that sitting on top. Okay? So. I'd just flag that even though I wrote this document, I discovered in the last few weeks that BITS had some tweaky stuff. There was some bug that got fixed, and there's an edit for branch cache coming along for the content caching document that actually explains what goes on. What it really came down to retries was that, what's the best way to describe this? If you're using BITS, the peers actually store the fact that they once got cache data, therefore that they know that the thing they were talking to is branch cache enabled. Okay, so there's a little bit of magic happens, but that, it's not really that magic. It's just basically, if it's ever received cache data, then with BITS, then it knows that that must be branch cache enabled, which means that if it tries to get a chunk of data and it fails first time round, it knows it goes Well, I know you really have data, honestly, and so we'll actually do retries in that circumstances that wouldn't do with just plain HTTP, okay? But we will get that. There'll be an updated document coming out in a few days, though. So how am I doing for time? So I'm going to dive in a little bit and just look at SMB2 and some of the sequences of things that happen because you know, we kind of skirted it very carefully over the issue. I go, oh, get me the file and I've got an ID. And clearly, that's not quite as simple as that. There's a little bit more that takes place in the process. Okay, so I've just got a kind of abbreviated capture, if you like, showing here. So I'm assuming people, so at least some of the people in the room are familiar with SMB2. But we do our normal session setup, which you would do. We do a tree connect. And then on the response with the tree connect, this is the first time that branch cache shows its head, as it were, in the system. You get back share flags. And the share flags, there's actually a flag in there that tells you whether branch cache is enabled on the share. Okay, so it's a per share thing that gets enabled. So that's the kind of, that doesn't mean there's hashes available. It just means somebody enabled it on the share. There's a bunch of other things that need to be true. So we get the share flags, and that, so that's the first hint to the client that says, hey, this guy might be branch cache enabled. In order to go ahead and actually use branch cache, you actually have to get an opwalk lease on it. You can't, you know, not all files are immediately cacheable, you know, and that's really nothing to do with branch cache. So you actually have to go and get an appropriate lease on it before you can go, oh yeah, it's safe to branch cache. You could still try and branch cache on it, but you know, if some other guy's doing piles of writes or something to it, presumably if you don't pay attention to this, things could go very badly wrong. Assuming that the share says it's enabled and we can get the appropriate lease on it, now we can actually go using SMB2, and there's an IO cuttle, an IO control, we can actually say, go read the hashes. And that's the bit that actually gives me the hashes back. Okay, so there's... Yeah, that's explicitly asking for them. So it's a kind of aligning the moons and suns in the right place. If all of that's true, now it's safe to go and get. I mean, I personally don't know the answer. I don't know if anyone else's rooms is. What happens if you ignore that, don't do that, and just try and grab... try to read the hash without trying to obtain the lease. I don't know. It'll say don't have one, but it will also, sorry, the question is, just repeat the question, is if you ask for the hash and there's not one available, what happens? And the answer is, it will start the generation process. But it will say to you, well, it doesn't. I mean, the honest answer is, I don't have a hash for you. Sorry, you know. So, but generation. Was that from looking on the wire? So this is just spelling out what was on that slide, basically. You know, you do your tree connect. There's just spelling out a little bit more. This is in the overview document, basically. The value of the flag shows, it says, indicates that caching, branch caching is enabled on the server share and that the server can respond to the request for metadata. I mean, if this doesn't show up, then, you know, the server's basically saying, I know nothing about branch cache, basically. So but once that's there, it says informs the client that it can make requests for metadata, but it doesn't guarantee it. So if the so this is just going on, we got to, and spelling out this bit I said before, you got to go and obtain your lease before you can just grab the data. And there we go. That was just the thing. Okay, so that basically is the SMB2 model. And then once you have the hashes, now you flip over into this other mode where you stop talking SMB2 in a sense, and you go off and you play the branch cache game that says, has anybody got the data that goes with these? And you go and so. That's just an example, just showing you actual breakdown from netmon of the sort of thing you actually see. Okay, showing you the so. Netmon knows about this stuff and will decode packets for you if you go and look at it. We got a little diagram again. This is stuff, content from the actual system overview document. We've got some architectural stuff that just shows how within Windows, actually, now this is a bit more Windows specific, how branch cache sort of sits in relation to other caches. Okay, so there's some details here about how it relates to client-side caching and so on. Okay, so if you're interested in that stuff, I'm here to sell you. Go read a document. That's what I'm trying to encourage you to do. Okay, so that would be good stuff to go and look at if you're interested. So enough of that for one moment. So that's essentially what the SMB2 picture looks like. Let's have a quick whiz through HTTP. So simpler model in a sense. So content client sends an HTTP GET. In the header, there's this PeerDIS. So we can talk about being PeerDIS enabled for HTTP. If that's true, then the client has the ability to respond with hashes, assuming it's got them. Now, the hash generation system is a little bit different in HTTP. You can't just whiz up hash gen and make it happen. You have to wait for the process to fire up itself. So the first time you ask, there's just not going to be a hash. That's pretty much guaranteed. And then that will kick off the process of hash generation. So first time up, we go get it. It says we get a HTTP GET. Content server indicates the content is encoded with PeerDIS, and the response will come back. When it comes back, though, you just be aware the content length indicates the length of the metadata, not the actual data that you were after. So there's a few things just to be careful over there. So this is just showing you an HTTP request first time. So accepted encodings, if you live in the HTTP world, you've seen this lots, gzip deflate, so PeerDIS is just a form of encoding. Okay, and actually some version number in there, but we've only got version 1 as it is at the moment. We got a response, so you get a payload and various other content length and various things showing in there the PeerDIS information. Just little word of warning, we depending on which if you use Netmon at all to look at this stuff, there has been some issues with the parsers and they've been updated pretty recently. You sometimes need to do a reassemble on this packet so that you can actually see. If you look in Netmon, if you use it, there's a little option that says reassemble. You sometimes need to do that to get it to decode stuff properly. This is just showing you the content. By the way, one of the things I find very helpful when messing around is this, to use the sound of a Windows equivalent of touch to change the date on files. It's the kind of safest way to make sure that it knows that it's got to go and regenerate a hash. If you just touch it, that usually encourages it. Because if you're testing this stuff at all, it's quite easy. Once you've got things in the system cached, it's quite hard to kind of flush the caches. So it's worth doing something like that if you're just sort of messing around and testing to see if things are working. This is just showing you, as I said before, I had a diagram showing the sort of architecture of how SMB2 is tied into the system. This is showing the kind of equivalent for HTTP. We touched on this quite a lot before, but so once we've got our content, now once we've got the hashes, clearly the type of hashing mode, type of branch cache mode we're in, hosted or distributed, matters now. We saw before and we discussed that if we are in hosted cache, then we must have been pre-configured with the name of the hosted cache, and we can go and find it and talk to that. And we saw as well that if we're in distributed mode, we need to go discover it. There's some detail here. Again, this is all in the branch cache overview document. There's some timers and things that gets initiated, so you can time out. Clearly, particularly true if you're waiting for a peer sort of thing, waiting for a peer to give you data. There are timers, and there's various default values you might be interested in. Little example, hosted cache. Should we get PeerDIS, we get the response. we get for ask for a block list, and that's a message from the protocols. You can get and you get returned a block list, and then having got the block list back, I can now ask for specific blocks that I want. Similarly, we saw the case where the client first gets the data and it wants to talk to the hosted cache. Then we might want to offer that data, and this is just an example of offering up. So we do the initial offer message. This sort of traffic is encrypted in SSL. There's a couple of things you can do, but Netmon actually allows you, if you've got the cert, you can actually decode SSL using Netmon, so you can get to see this this traffic. This is just showing you, you can switch client authentication on or off. Again, it's a setting. And this is just showing you what the traffic would look like if you talk a client's talking to a hosted cache and we get authentication taking place. So that. Again, revisiting this stuff, we said if we're in distributed mode, we need to go discover our data. Okay, so that's slightly different. And so we've got a lot of some architectural diagrams and things in the document that just shows a bit more, explains a bit more of how the web service discovery works, where you know you get your hash from your content server, then you do a multicast, and then appropriate ones reply, okay, and then you can kind of proceed. And there's a bunch of rules around how many peers you can deal with at one time. There's you know a bunch of other stuff that's relevant. There you go. I don't know if anyone's mentioned this before. I don't know the answer, Daryl, given I've not been here. We have a website where the system documents that I listed at the beginning, there's captures that are associated with the system documents, and they're annotated captures. Rather embarrassingly, I'm standing here talking about branch cache, and the branch cache one isn't there because they've had some problems. But it will be there in the next few weeks. But basically, you get network captures, Netmon network captures, that are annotated with the sections of the document that you need to read to understand the relevant packets. Okay, so if you want some of that. And I'm done, I think, nearly enough. So there you go. Content caching, basically protocol family document for the feature that makes up branch cache. There's a bunch of stuff on TechNet as well, if you're interested, in addition to the protocol documentation and the protocol overview document. Are there any limitations or caveats? You want to elaborate? There's lots. You have anything specific in mind when you ask that question? Well, there's limits, like the number, the number of peers you can talk to, for instance, would be a limit. You know, so it depends what you mean by limits. I don't know, that's quite. We can talk about it offline if you want, if you get specific ideas. But there are a bunch of limits, and they are in the for various things. How often I might go look, you know, which peers I would look for, how long I would wait. If bottom line, branch cache doesn't work, you just get normal file retrieval. Yeah, that would be true. So any specific scenarios I'm aware of that branch cache won't work? I'm going to look at the back of the room and see if he wants to shout.
No, I think you're asking for scenarios where you would expect it to be applicable.
Sorry.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I heard the question properly. You're interested in scenarios where you'd expect branch cache to be applicable, but it's not. I don't know.
That's a hard one, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't really have any surprises that I'd hide from you. I'm not sure that I know. I'm not sure that I know a scenario that you'd expect it to work in where
Let me speculate. It's not going to work with FTP. Because it's not enabled.
Okay. If it wasn't clear, it only works for the HTTP and SMB protocols, right? Those are the only two that we've instrumented. There was a platform slide up there. We do provide an API that you can use to instrument protocols other than HTTP and SMB on Windows. So there may be other protocols down the line in the future, maybe even the Windows 7 timeframe. But out of the box, HTTP and SMB are the only ones. So I don't know. That was probably clear, just in case.
So on the
But, you know, there was, do you want to repeat the question? It wasn't really a question. It was just stating one of the other limits might be block sizes. You might want to change block sizes and things. What I was going to just say about it in general is it's a pretty simple model, really. And, for the scenarios that it's intended to work in, it works pretty nicely, frankly. I mean, I'm actually quite an enthusiast of it, just simply because I sit at home and I use it, it's just cut out for me personally lots of copying between machines that I didn't really want to do. And so it's quite nice that it's just transparent and it happens. So from that point of view, it's pretty nice. I mean, I'm sure there are the people in the room, there must be some LAN accelerator people or some such thing. I mean, I guess they're the sort of people that might be interested in this as well. Yeah. Question? Okay, so you look like you're ready to go.
Sure, in fact, I am, yeah. So you may have... I can handle that. The question was if you have two different files that have the same segment within them, the hashes will line up, provided those 30...
No, not the block hashes.
Right, no... If the first 32 megabytes are exactly the same between two different files, that first segment will have the same segment hash, provided the two files come also from the same server.
So you can say that
Right. So perhaps it'll make it clear if we describe this, right? We cut up all of the content into 64 kilobyte blocks, and then we group those 64 kilobyte blocks into 32 megabyte segments. And if you have an identical set of blocks that map to an identical segment, between different files, the hashes will be the same and there will be sharing.
But the key used for
Right. So what we didn't show in the talk today is there's an additional piece of an additional salt that should be unique for each content server that's added into or involved in the computation of the segment hash. So if you have different cryptographic salt between different servers, you may have identical files on those servers that have different different hashes, basically. But it is possible on Windows to replicate that cryptographic hash or just set it to be the same across multiple content servers. So that's possible. You can enable some amount of sharing.
Oh, the latency. Is that what you were talking? Sorry. When it would get invalidated. Content's no longer valid. Content's gone away would be a really good example.
So we don't actually work quite that way. In Windows, what we'll do is we'll hold on to data, and we'll just push data out of the cache on sort of a least recently used basis. So we'll fill up a fixed amount of space on disk, and then as you put more things in there, the old stuff that is invalid will get pushed out. But we don't do anything to go and detect that a file has changed and we should delete things. It's not active. So the question was, are we taking updates from the server to know whether or not content has changed? And the answer is no, but we don't have a staleness problem. And the reason is, if a client wants to go and download something from the branch cache, he will go to the content server every time to retrieve hashes for that content. So the content's changed, you won't find the old invalid stuff in the cache, and you're good to go.
How does this manifest in QoS?
The question is, if I'm writing an application, how do I take advantage of branch cache? And it's if you're using the built-in SMB or HTTP stacks in Windows, if you're using WinINET or WinHTTP, and you're speaking to a server-side app that's using HTTP sys, branch cache will kick in automatically. There's nothing that you need to do as the app author, provided you're pushing out content that's marked as cacheable. So there's nothing. If you're using the stacks in Windows, you'll benefit from branch cache automatically.
How about if I simply program using
And provided everything is going over, right, when you move over and start using SMB, yes, you'll benefit automatically.
It's quite friendly.
I should say something that we had in mind, too, is apps that you might have written for down-level versions or older versions of Windows may well benefit and speed up, just get faster when they're used on Windows 7 and R2. I can handle that one as well.
Cool,
so
yeah.
The question is, I think you're asking about specifically about DFS, right? When is branch cache a good choice over DFS? Right. So with branch cache, the content is always going to be transferred over the WAN link on first access. So if you've got a big document and somebody's coming in at 9 a.m. and you're using branch cache, it's not going to be cached ahead of time. And the first guy to download is going to have to pull the whole thing over the WAN link. Of course, that's not the situation with DFS, where you can actively push large stuff ahead of time. So branch cache is a better choice in one of those cases where you don't know ahead of time the total sum of things that you want to be available in the branch, or you don't know or you don't want to spend the bandwidth preemptively pushing stuff into your branch locations. Branch cache is going to be a better choice there. And then the other obvious thing is branch cache does more than just file traffic, right? We also do HTTP, so branch cache will speed that up, and DFS really won't. Helpful? Yes, that's...
Big difference there is you know what you want. Normally, don't you?
I'm planning on sticking around for the free lunch afterwards. You can come in.
Hey, there's no such thing as a free lunch.
I'll be around.
There is today.
Nice guys.
Although, yeah, it's not
good. That's right. Well, thank you very much, Neil. Thank you for coming today. Tom's here also from the product team, so we really appreciate that. A couple of things I'll point out, two resources. Tom talked about system documents. And I will point out that we have, for example, you referred to DISO and ADSO, MS-DISO, MS-ADSO. They talk about some of the scenarios, server to server, why you refer to a file server as a client in the AD area, all of these things that will twist your brain. The system document discussions have been recorded from the Active Directory PlugFest and are available on channel9.msdn.com, along with FSSO, the file systems document, which relates to the branch cache presentation we had today. There is also last year's presentation, which I believe presented last year.
It wasn't me, but it was somebody else on my team, Randy.
That's right.
Yeah,
okay,
that's right.
So Randy had presented about Branchcast last year, which is recorded and posted to Channel 9.
All right.
So no, those... No. And we'll both turn off our microphones now since we're done.